What drives someone who's already made billions to keep building, keep disrupting, keep chasing the next impossible thing? Jim Clark, high school dropout, Navy veteran, Stanford professor, had already founded three multi-billion dollar companies by the late 1990s. Yet there he was, standing on the bow of his 157-foot computerized sailboat in 70-mile-per-hour North Sea winds, beneath a 189-foot mast that was swaying dangerously because its rubber seal had frozen and shattered. Most people would have retreated to safety. Clark just stood there, watching his technological experiment push past its limits, exactly as he'd done with every venture he'd ever touched. This restlessness, this inability to settle for what already exists, reshaped Silicon Valley and created what one venture capitalist called the greatest legal creation of wealth in the history of the planet. Understanding Clark means understanding the peculiar alchemy that transforms ideas into empires and why some people can never stop searching for what comes next. Clark's superpower was seeing around corners. Venture capitalist John Durr called it amazing over-the-horizon radar. Engineer Kittu Kaluri compared it to an animal's sense of smell. His enemies called it luck. But luck doesn't explain founding Silicon Graphics in 1982 with a revolutionary chip that gave computers three-dimensional vision. While IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and DEC passed on licensing opportunities, Hollywood grasped it immediately. Spielberg and Lucas became early customers, using SGI workstations to create effects that transformed cinema. Greg Chesson from Bell Labs saw a computer-generated Snoopy flying across Clark's screen in 1981 and thought, "All right, here is where I work now." Clark assembled brilliant engineers through the magnetic pull of revolutionary work. His genius lay in understanding that the world is three-dimensional, so eventually computers would need to be too, a simple observation that unlocked billions in value. Silicon Graphics taught Clark a brutal lesson. Capitalism screws creators. His first venture deals sold 40% of SGI to Glenn Mueller's Mayfield Fund for $800,000, while Clark kept just 15%. As hardware development burned cash, engineers sold more equity. Before earning their first dollar, they were squeezed out. Mayfield ultimately made $400 million, while SGI created few engineer millionaires. Clark took this personally, his face reddening in board meetings as he accused Glenn of cheating him. When new CEO Ed McCracken arrived from Hewlett-Packard, wearing suits, speaking with unnatural sincerity, preferring consensus over conflict, the clash became inevitable. Under McCracken, SGI thrived financially, growing from 200 to 6,000 employees with billions in revenue. But Clark was systematically marginalized, even having his compensation reduced while McCracken's increased. This wasn't just business. It was a fundamental fight about who deserves to win when brilliant ideas meet corporate reality. A 1992 motorcycle accident left Clark bedridden, during which he wrote a paper on interactive television that inadvertently led major tech companies astray. By early 1994, having left SGI vowing to show fucking Ed McCracken who truly built the company, Clark met Marc Andreessen, co-creator of Mosaic. When Andreessen suggested building a Mosaic killer, Clark recognized the opportunity. With 25 million internet users doubling yearly, he realized, Jesus, those are big numbers. I've never been in a business with those kind of big numbers. Within 18 months of launching Netscape, Microsoft reassigned thousands of employees to compete. When venture capitalists arrived, Clark demanded unprecedented terms, an $18 million valuation with his dollars worth three times theirs. John Doerr of Kleiner Perkins accepted, marking the defining moment for this period in the Valley. Netscape's IPO, 18 months after founding, rewrote capitalism's rules. Companies no longer needed profits, just rapid growth and potential. Engineers became instant millionaires, with Clark ensuring Marc Andreessen wouldn't suffer his own earlier fate at SGI. After finishing with Netscape in fall 1995, convinced Microsoft would eventually devour it, Clark plotted his next billion-dollar venture. His hemochromatosis diagnosis exposed him to hospital bureaucracy, inspiring his next idea, revolutionizing healthcare by eliminating wasteful paperwork through internet technology. He sketched a magic diamond diagram connecting patients, doctors, pharmacies, and insurers through a central hub called Healthscape. By eliminating just half the industry's waste, he could build a company bigger than Microsoft. When Clark approached venture capitalists, making clear he wouldn't work day to day, VCs eagerly funded whatever he proposed at inflated terms. When Pavan Nigam resigned from Silicon Graphics to join Clark's healthcare venture in February 1996, his fax machine overflowed with hundreds of resumes within hours. The team, six Indians, two Italians, a Japanese, and a Belgian, intended to transform American healthcare despite knowing nothing about it. When Healtheon ran out of money in September 1997, venture capitalists valued it at zero. Clark offered to personally provide all $20 million needed, forcing VCs to contribute $8 million while fearing they'd miss out on something Clark saw. When the IPO roadshow collapsed after a devastating Wall Street Journal article, Clark offered to supply $40 million himself, nearly 20% of his after-tax Netscape wealth. Despite collapsing tech stocks, he remained confident, "I'll be a billionaire again soon." For Clark, launching Healtheon was just another step in his relentless pursuit. Having created three multi-billion dollar companies wasn't enough. He was doomed to be forever searching for the new thing. In spring 1999, frustrated by wealth management hassles, he envisioned MyCFO to organize America's 180,000 deca-millionaires controlling $15 trillion. Despite previously claiming he'd retire once becoming a real after-tax billionaire, Clark revealed a new goal. "I just want to make more money than Larry Ellison." With Ellison worth $9 billion and Clark at $3 billion, this seemed achievable. When pressed further, Clark admitted, "Just for one tiny moment, I would kind of like to have the most." Each milestone simply revealed a higher peak to climb. Plainview, Texas sits on a massive aquifer that once made it America's most fertile cotton land. By Clark's childhood, high-tech farming had disrupted family farms, starting a long decline. Clark's visits home are rare. He lands at the airfield, lunches with his mother Hazel, and quickly departs. His arrivals are local events. Residents recognize his distinctive jet. Hazel learns most about her son's accomplishments through magazines, struggling to reconcile the boy she raised with the famous innovator. Her memories offer glimpses: a four-year-old with remarkable memory, a 12-year-old who built model airplanes while recovering from accidentally shooting his foot, and a child who stole Christmas lights because the family couldn't afford them. The most disturbing memories involve Clark's alcoholic father, Charles, whose abuse led to divorce when Jim was 14. Charles continued terrorizing the family until 16-year-old Jim confronted him. He returned crying, and though neither Hazel nor Sue learned what happened, Charles never bothered Hazel again. As Hyperion sailed into Antigua's harbor, the author found Clark studying architectural drawings for a new sailboat, half again as large. Clark understood. The comfortable present is the enemy of the revolutionary future. His genius wasn't just technical vision, it was his refusal to let success become a stopping point. The high school dropout from Plainview didn't just build companies, he rewrote the rules about who gets to win and what becomes possible when you never stop searching for the new thing.